Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Fearscape Media Network, exploring the unknown, one podcast at a time.
Thank you for tuning in to Fearscape Paranormal Podcast. We are on a journey to understand and to discover the phenomena that seems to exist all around the globe. We invite you to join us on this journey into the unknown.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another, well, not just any other, but our season finale for 2021 episode of Fearscape Paranormal Podcast here on the Fearscape Media Network. I am your host, Stefan, the man that is super awesome, Gearheart, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Josh Rutledge, who I would describe as the most perfect gentleman that ever existed.
Well, that's a lot of pressure to put on my shoulders.
See, I try to give you a compliment.
I know,
you can't take it.
But you know, I've already kind of hunched over a little bit because my counterweight pulls me down. So I don't need all the extra pressure on my shoulders.
That's dumb. I'm going to use you as a fishing lure. That's where we're at. I'll throw you in and catch a cryptid fish, man.
So I always talk to my doctor, you know, he'd say, how tall are you? And I said, well, I'm 5'10", but my counterweight pulls me down to 5'9".
Yep, it's not nice. That's not nice at all. Josh, we got a fun episode, man. This is our just a reminder. This is our season finale. We're going to be taking the month of December off so that we can spend some time with our family, though we will have some special bonus episodes and some fun stuff coming out. It'll be fun, but not your standard get them and grip them podcast episodes.
That sounds like a sounds like a commercial for Grippos or something.
I know. Oh man, I miss Grippos. If y'all ain't from the Louisville, Cincinnati area, you won't even know what that is. But man, so. I love Grippos. Great barbecue chips. Anyways, we got a fun show tonight, man. We have a guy we've been wanting on the show for a while. We've got Walter Bosley coming on the show. We're gonna be getting spooky with Walter Bosley. This dude is legit, man. Dude is a ufologist. He's an author. He's been a guest on Ancient Aliens. He is a publisher, and listen to this is what I love. He's a publisher of a small press that has the best name ever, Lost Continent Library, which, you know, fits all of our favorite stuff all the way.
Yep.
Dude is a private investigator. He's worked for the FBI, the United States Air Force, and was even a consultant for counterterrorism. And I mean, the list can go on and on and on.
And it does.
He writes fiction and nonfiction, investigating strange mysteries. I mean, dude does it all. And we are so excited to be picking his brain tonight.
Yep. Going to be a fantastic conversation. So make sure you hang around.
Yep. You got to stick them and grip them. I don't know what I said earlier, but we're going to be doing that tonight. But yeah, before we get to that, we got to get to our segments of the week, man, because we got some interesting stuff. And of course, before we get to our segments, just a quick reminder to check out fearscapepodcast.com for all things Fearscape Podcast. There you can go to fearscapepodcast.com/support to follow our Patreon and, you know, be a donator. Or you can go to buymeacoffee.com if you're a one-timer. You got $5 in your pocket and you want to help us, you know, in any way you can, especially for the holidays. You can go to buymeacoffee.com right there and just do a one-time gift, as well as Christmas is around the corner, man. It's like a month away, and so, you know, fearscapepodcast.com/store, you can get all your fun Fearscape, not just Fearscape Podcast stuff, but Fearscape Media stuff. So all the other shows got stuff on there. We've got all kinds of Sasquatch shirts and alien shirts and all kinds of fun
Sure. And I don't want to alienate anyone. So you could buy it for Hanukkah. You could buy it for Festivus. You could buy it for Kwanzaa. You can buy it for Yule, whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
Buy a mm-hmm. shirt.
Even, you know, if you just celebrated Diwali, you can, you know, do that right. as well. Yeah. So, or just like Santosh. Santosh's birthday is in December, December 28th. He's the reason for the season. He's in between there. So, you know, buy Santosh a gift. Just let us know. We'll get it to him. So, anyways, let's go ahead and get to our first segment, which is Psychic Word of the Week.
And now, the psychic word of the week.
Psychic word of the week comes from the Encyclopedic Psychic Dictionary by June G. Bletzer, the ghost of Christmas psychic past. Rest in peace, honey bear. So I flipped through the pages, Josh, and I landed on page 527. And I landed on a phrase that is going to cut a little close to home for you. It's okay. called the real divining rod. This is like the real medium, like Vashti, but the real... Right. divining rod. And it's actually pretty interesting. And of course, the subcategory here is dowsing. But anyways, it says the right arm and right hand of the body is considered the real divining rod. To stretch out one's arm and tune into the feeling of the arm may move, twitch, quiver, or become cold or hot to indicate to the dowser when the hidden substance has been located. And so essentially this is saying you can simply use your arm as a divining rod or even pendulum style. It shows pendulum was in parentheses there as well. You could use it if you trust it and, you know, you're not moving it, to, you know, let your hand do its thing over some words or anything really.
So makes you wonder if when we do Ouija, we should all use your right arm, right hand.
I mean, I pretty much do, depending where I sit. But yeah, I mean, I pretty much do. And I don't know if that's a rightist thing. All the lefties out there, you know, I think maybe this was still the 80s when this book was written. So maybe he's just saying your dominant hand. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that's pretty interesting to say that your arm and your hand is the real divining rod, that we don't need sticks, we don't need copper divining rods or anything like that. You can literally just use your own arm. Interesting. It's the poor man's divining rod.
So you just hold it out and go no 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 no.
Yeah, no 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 no. Exactly. So, but you know, and this goes back to what Santosh, me and you constantly talk about is how powerful we all already are. We just haven't tapped into it, right? Yeah. Or we haven't opened
everyone,
that pathway.
Not the three of us.
No, right? No. But I mean, everyone. We are extra power. We are a triumvirate. Okay. But yes, everyone is powerful. We are Hermione, Harry, and Ron. Okay. You're totally Hermione.
I'm definitely Ron.
No, you're definitely Hermione because you're the nerd that's always correct. No, I guess Santosh sometimes corrects everybody too. Harry, so it doesn't matter.
No, yeah, you're the boy who lived. Yeah, that's right.
Anyways, I don't want to get into that. But anyways, yeah. So thank you, June G. Bletzer. Merry Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever you're celebrating up there in the great beyond. We love you, and I know the veil is still thin and it's getting darker, and you can come visit. Come visit. I would love to say hi to your spirit.
Just hold your right hand out. She's like,
yes,
give you a high five.
Give me a high five. All right. So let's go ahead and get to our next segment. Our final one for the year. Our cryptid of the week.
Oh, hell yeah.
Hi, y'all. It's the Jersey Devil. Hope y'all are ready to meet some of my friends.
Cryptid.
All right, We are here. My name is the Jersey Devil. Thank you all. Josh is going to be talking about one of my friends. What is this? This is a happy Hana Christmas cook. Everybody, I'm just so excited to be here. I love the holiday season. I get to go to Stefan's family's house and see Trisha. She is such an amazing person. You know, she got to talk to my dead grandmother.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Come to find out, my dead grandmother was actually a cow.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if it was physically bovine or if it was if it was just a large person. Not sure. But I don't think that's hilarious. You're going to laugh at my grandmother, Josh.
Oh, man.
Well, whatever. Anyways, Josh, so what do we got for Cryptid of the Week while Stefan's in the bathroom going potty train?
Potty train? No, never mind. I don't want to get into it.
Okay, all right. We'll go into it.
So, tonight's Cryptid of the Week is actually a plant.
Like Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors?
Yeah.
Little Shop of Horses?
It's actually the cosmic tree.
Oh, that now I think you're getting into some of that Thor stuff, right? Like yeah. The Viking stuff.
Yeah, is Stefan back yet?
Nope.
All right, so world trees.
Oh wait, I hear choo choo. He's getting off the potty train. He's got to finish up the caboose.
Okay. So world trees or cosmic trees are a prevalent motif occurring in the mythical creation accounts, iconographies of the pre-Columbian cultures of Mesoamerica. In the Mesoamerican context, world trees embodied the four cardinal directions, which also served to represent the foretold nature of a central world tree, a symbolic axis mundi which connects the planes of the underworld and the sky with that of the terrestrial realm. Many people argue that they are more myth than cryptid. Depictions of world trees, both in their directional and central aspects, are found in the art of mythological traditions of culture such as the Maya, Aztec, Izipan, Mixtec, Olmec, and some others, dating to at least the mid to late formative periods of Mesoamerican chronology. Among the Maya, the central world tree was conceived as a representative of a ceiba tree. I'm probably saying that wrong, and is known variously as a waka chan or a yax imix chi, depending on the Mayan language.
Waka waka waka, Josh. JD just passed me. I heard all of that, but on the way out, he was mad because he said if it don't have teeth, it's not a cryptid.
Well, so I mean,
he just kind of got really mad.
Trees.
He said this is not part of his family.
Oh, well, I mean, how does he know? Maybe he's a seed from the tree.
I don't know. Do I look like the Jersey Devil? But yeah, I mean, that is my question as well. How? So we said that it's more. What did you say? More mystical than cryptid.
Myth and cryptid, but
what makes it cryptid?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it's in the cryptid category. I mean, I don't know how you want me to answer here, but world trees are frequently depicted with birds in their branches, their roots extending into the earth or the water. I guess what makes it a cryptid is that it's not just a tree. It's almost like a being.
Right. It's magical in nature.
Right. So.
No, but not along the lines of like tree beard. You know, that definitely gives a sentience in a different way.
Right. But this is sentience that is connective in nature. It reminds me of the tree of life or whatever it is from Avatar, the one that they all go and, you know, it's got that thing and glowing branches and everything. I mean, that is a connection point for their, you know, for the planet. And so this is the way I kind of see this is the same. So it has some level of intelligence and sentience there, even though it's not, it doesn't have teeth.
Yeah. And so to add to that, so I looked up the definition of cryptid. Definition of cryptid is, in cryptid zoology and sometimes cryptobotany, a cryptid is a creature or plant whose existence has been suggested but is not recognized by scientific consensus. So yes, it does indeed fit into that because plants are indeed alive.
What? Wait a minute. Plants are alive?
Yeah. So every time you're eating your salad, vegans, you're killing something. It's screaming. No. But there was this comic book back in the day called The Freshman. Seth Green. I don't know if he wrote it or if one of the characters was just based off of him. But they all got superpowers that happened to coincide with like what they were doing at the moment of whatever they were doing or whatever, or things about them. And this one guy was a vegetarian. And so his superpowers was that he could communicate and hear plants. And so he was mid eating his salad when he heard each salad leaf scream in pain. Wow. As he was eating it.
Wow. And
so all of a sudden he was like, what am I supposed to eat? Like, because his whole reason for being a vegetarian was he didn't want to take life.
Right. But life is everywhere. Mm-hmm. Even water has life, as that documentary says.
Yeah. And even then, I think that tree does fit into, like JD was talking about, into Ossetru lore and Viking lore and things like that, because that tree kind of represents the realms, you know, and stuff like that. So,
I mean, the world tree,
yeah.
The kind of sacred tree, you know, is always exists all over the place.
Oh, so. Especially in Druid culture and you know, the United Kingdom there, old Druid. Yep. I mean, all their trees had sacred meanings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, but very, very cool, man. All right. Well, JD's still a little peeved back there, but let him have it. I'm gonna get him a good holiday present, so it won't even matter. But let's go ahead and move to our final segment before we get to Mr. Walter Bosley, which is Creepy Ketchup.
Creepy catch up. Y'all, it's creepy.
Oh man, Josh. Man, we got some creepy catch up. It has been a minute for both of us to have some creepy catch up, but it's just been like that. I guess, because, yep, you know, it's getting darker and stuff be happening. I don't know what you got, if you wanted to go first or if you wanted me to go first, but it's all good.
Yeah, I mean, mine's short.
Okay, so yeah.
I'll go first. So, you know, a couple weekends back, I went to Wild and Weird Con out in West Virginia
big shout Joe out to
Purdue and Ron, you know,
and Ron, and rest in peace, Wayne Barnes, man.
Yep. And it was great. And so we were Kristen went with me, and we were driving back, and it was late at night. Like, it was dark, you know, and so my headlights were catching, you know, the kind of the road signs on the road stuff and lighting them up. Well, I came upon this one road sign, and I saw perched atop it what looked like, what I can only describe as my interpretation of the Mothman.
I can already hear Keith. It's an owl, Josh.
Well, it didn't have any red eyes, but it did have just kind of the hump. Mm-hmm. It looked like it had wings, you know, kind of tucked down, folded down like an owl or like a bird or something. And it was just kind of perched upon the sun. And as I approached it, it just phased out. It just disappeared.
Ooh, how big was it?
I mean, the road sign was probably a good 5 feet off the ground, and it was probably a good 5 or 6 feet sitting or perched atop the roadside.
Gee, so massive.
Yeah. And it was crazy, because, like I said, and what's really even crazier is we were driving out to this really dark area that Joe had told me about, to look at the stars and UFOs and all that kind of jazz, which Kristen got a little freaked out. We ended up going back to the room, but yeah, so I was driving to look at UFOs, and along the way saw this sitting on atop a road. And like I said, as I got closer and closer, it just kind of phased away, and it just wasn't there anymore.
Well, oddly enough, my event happens on the road as well. So last week, my sister came in from Detroit, my older sister. And we got to spend some time. We went out to Prescott. Nothing actually happened this year in Prescott, and the moon was out, so I couldn't get any good starfield photos and things like that, though it was still beautiful. But the day before we left for Prescott, we took a trip to the Grand Canyon. And we were driving back pretty late from the Grand Canyon, and everyone was asleep except for this guy, because I was driving and everyone's passed out from hiking all day in the Grand Canyon. So I had to write all this down. So if I sound a little robot-y, it's because I'm reading my notes here. But it says, so on the drive home from the Grand Canyon, we were just outside of Grand Canyon Village in Tunesa, I think is the name of the town that's right outside Grand Canyon National Park. We were heading south. We were just leaving town. So when we were maybe a half hour away from that city, so we're pretty far out enough where it's pretty blackout. You know, this is a good where I tell people to stop to go look at the stars, essentially, yeah. Because there's no mountains around. You're out of the Grand Canyon, but you haven't hit like the main kind of Maricopa Phoenix kind of mountainsy. So there's this huge just flat land, even though you're like still 8,000 feet up, it's just flat for like miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. So anyways, we're there and I'm driving and I just look into the sky and I see this grouping of six or seven lights just in a stair step position going from left to right. So, so going like left to right going down, right? So stair step going down.
Were they out your front windshield?
Yeah, they're in my front window. Okay. They're in my front windshield. I'm driving south, so this would have been to the southeast. Southeast a little bit, directly in front of me though, and I was able to figure things out because directly in front of me was Orion's belt. And Orion was on his side, so it looked going straight up. So these were stair stepped though. I mean, going diagonal up, but stair, it looked like stairs to me. Okay. Like that was the best way that I could put it. They were stationary for quite some time. They weren't very bright. That was the other thing that got me, is they weren't very bright. They were, I can't remember if they were as bright or less bright than Orion's belt, but they were pretty close to that, but they were much larger. Okay. So these are much larger lights than the stars in Orion's belt, but way, way bigger.
Like Venus kind of brightness.
Yeah. Venus. Well, no, Venus is way too bright.
Okay.
This is a normal starlight. So it's that kind of dull light. Okay. But as big, like probably a quarter bigger than what Venus would be, but six of them. Okay. But the light's duller. So that's what weirded me out more than anything.
Yeah.
Because at the same time, I'm looking around and I'm seeing planes or helicopters off in the distance doing their blinking and flying around. Those lights were very bright. You know what those look like. And these, like I said, were just frozen in the sky. I have looked at the sky a million times. I know Orion's belt. I have never seen a stair step pattern of stars. And it's just sitting there and it's not moving. And I'm like, what the heck, man? So we keep going. And like I said, there's no mountains around, probably not for another 100 miles. So this wouldn't have been a mountain, you know, like that lights were up on, you know, like if somebody lived up there or something like that, because there was no mountains around. Yeah. This definitely, we would have, if there would have been a mountain, you'd be able to see the silhouette of the mountain because the lights from Phoenix are so bright that we would have seen that. I didn't see any of that. Anyways, so I'm driving, I'm watching this man for like 10 minutes. I'm just like fascinated by this stair step pattern because they're all equal in size. And I'm just watching this. And then all of a sudden they begin moving from left to right in formation across the sky in that same pattern. So they're moving collectively at the same speed, keeping that stair step pattern, all of a sudden moving across the sky. And I know they're moving across the sky because they move in front of Orion's belt. And I can see Orion's belt disappear, which means this is in front of it.
Right.
So this is moving and I'm flipping out, dude. I'm watching this and it's going really slow. I was not in any curve. This is a straight path through the desert. There's no curve for miles and miles and miles. So it wasn't like the sky was moving. You know what I mean? Like, this was just moving. Then all of a sudden, Josh, they formed into a freaking straight line going up, and like straight line, like Orion's belt was like. So the one stopped and then it caught up until it's one straight line. And again, I'm freaking out. And the straight line. And I noticed this because they matched right to the right or left of them. It matched the same of Orion's belt
angle.
Yeah. So the same angle as Orion's belt. It was like they were two paths next to each other. It was pretty crazy. So let's see here. Again, these were less bright. Oh, so it is here. So it's in my notes. These were less bright than Orion's belt, but they were larger in size. This is, I would say, probably three times the size of the stars in Orion. But, but Venus was much bigger. So that still fits about that, a little bit bigger than Venus. And then all of a sudden, one at a time, they shot off into the sky. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in a row. Pew, 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 and got smaller and smaller until they disappeared, going straight up into the sky. And I'm just like, my mouth is hanging open and I'm like, holy crap. And then literally like 5 minutes after that, I see an orange light shooting from the sky in my southwest, heading to the southeast. And this thing is moving faster than I've ever seen anything go. It's an orange light, like I said, and it's about the same size as those things that I had seen. So maybe like, I put here half the size of a ping pong ball or maybe a nickel. It was fairly dim as well, shot across the sky so fast that I thought for a second it might have been a shooting star, but it was literally shooting across the sky, not coming from the top. It's shooting across the sky. It didn't burn up or anything, but then all of a sudden it just blinks out. It doesn't fade out like a shooting star does. It blinks out, and then maybe a second and a half, 2 seconds later, blinks back on, and even brighter than it was, and then goes out again. It says, and then a few minutes later, I'm trying to figure out where it is over to the left of me because it went out again. It did this twice, and then like literally like probably 30 seconds to a minute later, I look over and I see the light come back up twice as bright as it was before, and then shoots and turns back the way it came, and then shoots upwards in the same area where the stair step light shot up into the sky. And I was like, holy crap. Holy crap. What did I just see? And everyone's sleeping. Of course, I'm trying to wake everybody up. Nobody's getting up. Like, you know, they're all just dead asleep. And so this was my little thing that I was like, oh my God, 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 don't forget this, don't forget this, don't forget this, don't forget this. And literally I had to stop. I stopped at the closest bathroom and I went in there, went into the bathroom, and then I documented it all real quick. So that was crazy. I checked later that night. I checked for planes and things like that, and I found the ones that I had seen earlier, the helicopters, the planes, the things that I had recognized. I looked for satellites, and there of course were satellites and stuff, but not like what I had seen. I mean, they don't sit like that, and there weren't six of them in a row like that or anything like that. The only thing that I might count is, but they said you couldn't see it in Phoenix, but they said in some parts of the eastern seaboard you were able to see a fireball that night. There was a fireball in the sky, but it said you could see it, as they were like, you could see it as far as Alabama. And I was like, well, that wouldn't have been Phoenix.
No.
And it wouldn't have turned around and then shot up either, but I don't know.
Yeah.
We're weird, man.
That's crazy though. And also note the mile marker so we can go and just sit out there on the side of the road with the psionics window.
Yeah, I have a general idea where it was, and I meant to look it up before I told everything tonight, but I didn't get a chance. But I've got a pretty damn good idea where it was, because I've driven that stretch 15 times over the last year. So, but anyways, so that's my creepy catch up, Josh, man. What an event.
Yeah. I mean, so we both had some really good sightings, or Yours is a lot better than mine, though.
No, yours is good, though, too. Reminded me of me and Santosh's monkey cat sighting back in the day. But anyways, we're going to go ahead and move right on and get to our interview with Walter Bosley. So please stick around. We will be right back.
How many greys do you think you've killed over the years?
19, pretty much for sure.
Because that day, even though I was a kid, I knew for a fact that what we had just witnessed wasn't human.
The only way that I could describe it was that there was a shadow stood there.
And I believe that it's potentially, I'm not saying 100% definitely, but potentially a real abduction caught on video camera.
Join Ash and me every Tuesday as we explore some of the lesser known but fascinating unusual stories from our unknown world. With the latest paranormal and UFO news, a look back at historical cases, and special guests joining us along the way, we aim to pursue the paranormal from a different point of view.
Pursuit of the Paranormal with Ash and Greg.
Hey there, blanket huggers. Stefan here from Fearscape Paranormal Podcast. Got some good news for you. If you want to join in on the investigation of the mystery of the recent emails from the man claiming to be Terry Rist to Josh and myself, aka the Spooky Crew, and his advice on where to look for more high strangeness, or if you simply want to become a patron blanket hugger for some cool swag and behind-the-scenes goodness, go ahead and join our Patreon at fearscapepodcast.com/support or patreon.com/fearscapepod. There you can get Riskwatch access to the Terry emails themselves, the WhatsApp conversation about it all with Josh, Stefan, Santosh, and Olaf Phillips, and even any clues that are new that we have found in other Fearscape-related bonus content. You can even help out and add anything that you have found to help us dive deeper into the mystery. And remember, you can also just be a normal blanket hugger, as there are a few non-wristwatch tiers for patrons not interested in Terry Rist and that journey. You'll still have access to bonus interviews, articles, and live Patreon-only Q&As, as well as early access and discounted tickets to events put on by Fearscape, such as psychic events, tarot readings, etc. Or you can simply support however you feel comfortable with tiers as low as $1. So join today. And welcome back, everybody. Thank you guys so much for sticking around. As promised, we've got Walter Bosley here with us. And we are so thankful for you to come on the show, Walter. Thank you so much, man. How are you?
Hey, doing great. I appreciate being on. I enjoy doing these things. I love talking about this stuff with folks.
Man, the more and more that we were talking about having you on, the more and more we're like, we have all kinds of stuff we can be talking to Walter about. So, yeah, we got lots of fun stuff we can be talking about. Right, Josh?
Oh, yeah. So, actually, something that's kind of been chomping at me a little bit, Walter, last couple of weeks or last month. I noticed that your little your publishing company that you run, Lost Continent Library. Is that still right?
Yes, that's it.
I'm just very intrigued by the name selection because Stefan and I have been talking a lot lately. We've had a lot of instances come up lately around the whole concept of Atlantis and Mu and
Lemuria,
the Lemuria,
Hollow Earth, all the fun right. stuff.
All the fun stuff. So it makes me wonder if your publishing company name has anything to do with any of that stuff.
Oh, absolutely. I love that stuff too. And how it came about. The full story was I met David Hatcher Childress in 2002. In fact, I went on two trips visiting the Mayan ruins in Mexico, central Mexico. I liked the first one so much in early 2002 that I went on the second one in November that he had that year. And then the following year in 2003, I went to South America with his group, his Adventures Unlimited Press World Explorers Club. And that was my first personal introduction to David Childress. And he really is a nice guy, great guy to travel with, very knowledgeable. Mm. And I had been, you know, reading some of his books before I met him. But, you know, I was thinking, I really liked what he did with his publishing company, Adventures Unlimited Press. Mm-hmm. And essentially it started out for him. He wanted to publish his own stuff, but also publish other authors. And I thought, you know what? I kind of like that business model.
Yeah.
What if I did that for pulp adventure fiction? Because I love Indiana Jones and all the pulp adventure fiction stuff. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to steal David's model. And I told him this. I go, I'm stealing your business model, and I'm going to apply it to adventure fiction and pulp and entertainment and stuff. And he thought that was a cool idea. So I thought, well, I got to come up with a name. The original incarnation was just a magazine. Okay. When I came up with the original idea, I just wanted to do a magazine like he does World Explorer magazine, but on my theme. And so I thought, well, gee, I got to come up with a name. And as I was thinking of a name, I thought, well, wait a minute. Why just do a magazine? Why not do a publishing label? And then that's where Library came in. But I thought, well, you know, Atlantis and, like you said, Lemuria is often a part of this. And I thought of the Library of Alexandria. Mm-hmm, I thought, well, what if the Library of Alexandria for adventures, you know, was in Atlantis? And I thought, okay, the Lost Continent. Oh, Lost Continent Library. It was really that simple. And, you know, I just kind of went from there. But that was, and I got the idea, you'll like this, I got the idea while I was in Khartoum, Sudan. I was on my job where I was doing counterterrorism work. I did that for about 6 years. But in when I came up with the idea for the publishing company, I was in, you know, North Africa right. on this adventurous job. So, you know, there's the origin of it.
Yeah, I was like, you're already doing your Indiana Jones, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, by the way, the company official colors are black and red, and black and red are colors of Atlantis, if you recall. In a lot of the literature, they talk about black and red, you know. So there you go. It absolutely is connected to Atlantis.
Very cool. Well, as Josh said, we are huge, you know, missing kingdom, country, people, and pulp fiction lovers as well. I mean, we were big Ray Palmer fans and Shaver Mystery and just all those. Yes. Uh-huh. You know, we are definitely old hearts as well, old souls. We love that good old stuff band. So I'm just looking over at a number of your publications, and I'm already like, gonna pick that one up, because just the covers alone, that's why I love the pulp the pulp story so much. It was the covers will grab you so quick.
Now, are you are you looking at the because I have my imprint, my nonfiction imprint, which is called Corvos. So I started doing nonfiction after my Disneyland book in 2008. Mm-hmm. By 2010, I decided, you know what, I'm going to do nonfiction as well. So you're probably seeing both the nonfiction.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at everything here. But the one that was popping to me was Green Ghost and House of
Comet. Oh, yes.
Those covers are beautiful, man.
Well, you know, I have to admit, I tell everybody up front, what I do is I take old pulp magazine art, which is in public domain, and I composite it. I pick a piece here, a piece there. And whenever I can identify the artist, I like to do that, you know, and of course. But yeah, it's a lot of fun.
We do a lot of that too. I like to take the old public domain
books
like that as well, and I'll use them for show cards and stuff as well. And I do improv comedy, so I've used them for a lot of flyers and stuff as well. Yeah,
yeah, it keeps it alive. It keeps it out there in front of, you know. It really does, and it's a great genre that I think still has value. And you know, so I like to try and do my part to keep it alive.
For sure. I mean, I'm reading the biography on Ray Palmer right now, and it's just absolutely fascinating. Like, just
a biography. Oh, I got to read that.
Yes. I'll let Josh talk for a second so I can find the book and tell you the name of it. But it's really, really good. And it's not just all Shaver Mystery stuff. I mean, it really goes into his whole life and just his, all his stuff. So,
you know, it's funny when we talked about, we did an episode where we talked about the Shaver Mystery, and we talked about Ray Palmer in that episode, and we wondered if he was the inspiration for the character in the comics, and we dismissed it as the Adam. We dismissed it as probably not. But somebody corrected us on YouTube and said, in fact, he was.
Yeah, he was. And the reason he was, they named him that, is because the Atom shrinks and gets small. And he was small like Ray Palmer was, because Ray Palmer was known to be the short guy. And so it was kind of a joke as well. But the book is called The Man from Mars, Ray Palmer's Amazing Pulp Journey. And it's by Fred Natus. It's excellent. It's
I got to read that. That's going to the top of my list on Amazon right there. Yeah,
yeah, it's excellent. And if you're a pulpy guy and you love Ray Palmer and all that stuff and amazing stories, this it's perfect. It's a great book.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. So, I mean, how could you not like the Shaver mystery?
I know.
Because it's got elements where late at night you're sitting there thinking, okay, could any of it be true? And
then and then we're always like, so what did Shaver actually write? And what did Palmer put in? Which parts are truth? Oh man.
Right, exactly.
who has that original manuscript? Like, it's gotta be laying around somewhere in somebody's old dusty drawer somewhere. So
yeah, who would have, I wonder who would have got that stuff after Palmer.
Yeah, so there's I think we were looking into it. They're just now trying to collect Shaver's stuff because mostly the focus has been on his art. So there's definitely some Ray Palmer stuff, but neither of them have like a museum, like even like Gray Barker has a museum. So because we've been looking into it and we've been talking to people here and there, but there has not been an effort to collect up until recently. I think it's like shavertron.com. They're trying to find old letters. They're trying to find everything they can that's Richard Shaver, because they too are trying to find the mystery of the Shaver mystery with his original manuscript. Like, what, because no one knows what Palmer changed.
Right. So yeah. What is the nugget of truth? What, now, this might help you. I don't know if you know William Michael Mott, you know, Mike Mott.
Mm-mm. We don't.
Okay. He wrote a book that's really popular with weirdos like us, Caverns, Cauldrons, I'm currently the publisher of his stuff, and I always screw up the title of this book, but his last name is Mott. You might want to contact him, because I can put you in touch with him, because one of the books he did that I'm publishing now is an edition of Shaver's This Tragic Earth, which Mike edited.
Wow.
And that's on my Corvos nonfiction. It's in the catalog. And so Mike Mott, I don't know, he might be able to shed some light on if he knows anything about.
Yeah, we are definitely trying to track it down. I mean, that to us is the holy grail, because we have been so immersed in Shaver and Hollow Earth this last year.
You know, I think what really interests us and grabs us with the Shaver stuff is, I'm somebody who I like to be honest. If I don't find evidence for something, I say, hey, I don't see evidence for it. Or if I disagree with I'll put my skeptic hat on. That comes from being a professional investigator. But as I remind people, I'm coming from a position of being someone who's open to, I dare say, believes in things. Okay. So I'm one of those that's in the believer camp that likes to be honest. And when it comes to Hollow Earth issues, personally, my gut feeling, my deepest belief is there is some truth to this. Mm-hmm. There's some nugget of reality about these subterranean spaces underneath our feet that are the reason we have these legends and stories. I firmly believe that.
I think about, the earth is like, and I'm going to use cake because I'm hungry. So the earth is like a cake. We're all sprinkles dancing around on top of the icing, but there's a whole lot of cake, right? And so who knows what the cream filling is? So,
think of an angel's food cake. Aren't there big gaps in the,
right? Yeah.
In the structure. So there could be in the earth. And then, you guys know this, when we're told that NASA in the early 60s said, gee, the moon is hollow, and then they shut their mouth about that, never mentioned it again.
Yeah, the bell rings. It rings like a bell, the moon does.
So I was going to mention, I read a book probably about a year ago. It's called flying ships, humanoids, and creatures of the subterranean world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a Saucerian roundtable discussion, and it has Gray Barker, Richard Shaver, Ray Palmer, Rampa, and Raymond Bernard. And it is an excellent book. I happen to get it in a PDF version as well from
Colvin, right?
And Andy Colvin, yep. And but in this book, there is sections where they're reading letters that were written back and forth between Shaver and Palmer, arguing around the structure of the book. And it's just, it's very insightful what was said. I mean, basically, you know, Shaver is calling Ray out, and Ray's like, you know, hey, you gave me like, you know, 15 paragraphs and I had to turn it into what it was. And so it's just, it's really interesting to read that, because it does give some insight into what Palmer added to it versus what the original manuscript might have contained.
Yeah, or what he took out.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Or what he took out. And we know that after all of that, Shaver just kind of ran with Palmer's ideas and just kind of went, in my opinion, fictionalized a lot of it. It's kind of how I feel about the Montauk Project. I feel like the first Montauk Project was pretty legit in terms of how they felt about it. And then after that, they're like, we got to keep writing more. And so they just kind of.
Yeah. So it went. Oh, and as far as that one went, I enjoyed the hell out of it, because I think I got four of those books.
Oh yeah, I've got four of them. That's where I'm at. So, I'm on the fourth one right now. So you know, I love them.
And yeah, even if you know you reach your point or you go, well, I don't know about this, but gosh, this stuff is so great.
Oh man, especially that first book though, man, that first book is just so scientific and so crazy good. You're like,
well, you know that stuff. Whew. When I was still an OSI agent, a badge carrying OSI agent, I found myself on Long Island. Now I lived on Long Island for 3 years when I worked for the FBI. My second wife, my son's mom, is from there, and my son was born there. So I'm familiar with Long Island, but I found myself back there when I was an OSI agent at the time, assigned to Wright-Patterson in Ohio. So I drove over during the Christmas season because my son was there. Mm-hmm. And I drove out to Montauk because I had a free afternoon and went snooping around Camp Hero. Yes. And I told myself, okay, Walter, if you're caught by anybody, you know, that says, oh, you know, what are you doing here? You've got a federal badge.
I was good, and
yeah,
this used to be Air Force property, Air Force installation. I'm an Air Force agent. Mm-hmm. At the time, I was chief of counter-espionage operations branch for OSI at Wright-Patt. So I had a counterintelligence reason for being there, so to speak. I'm doing air quotes. So I had my story ready to go, that I know what to work on any cop or security guy. But, you know, here I am, a 36-year-old grown man, federal agent in the Air Force. Yeah, I ought to know better than these legends and things, but that Montauk stuff was so interesting that when I got my opportunity, it didn't matter what I was or how responsible, so to speak, that I was as an adult. What did I do? I went out there to snoop around, to, you know, because it was this stuff is just such a legitimate draw.
Yeah,
you know, it's really interesting. I'm curious why it was there, but I watch a show on CBS called Blue Bloods. It's got Magnum P.I., Tom Selleck, some other people in it. But anyways, in the last episode that came out week before last, in one scene, there's a picture hanging on the wall of a lighthouse, and it says Montauk underneath of it. And then later on in another scene, they're getting ready to sit down and watch a home movie, and they're like, oh, these are great home movies for Montauk. Like,
and that was it? They just left it?
That was it. They just left it.
And you know what's interesting about that, particularly if you've lived on Long Island? Most people, when they talk about, oh, the family went on a vacation, or the family took some holiday time, they say the Hamptons. And you don't have to be rich to go out to the Hamptons. It's interesting that they would specify Montauk on the show, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it makes you wonder if, like, you know, we have talked about, is Hollywood a delivery mechanism for disclosure?
Yeah.
Right. And the things that the, you know, the movies and the TV shows that we've been watching over the last, you know, 30 years, just a means to introduce our minds to all these concepts so that when they come to light, it won't be such a shock to the system. And so it makes you wonder if, you know, the mention of Montauk here was somehow purposeful towards that end. So,
right. And that has been an idea that, you know, it's very intriguing. People have talked about that, I think, specifically since Close Encounters. I first heard about this in the early 80s. I was in a filmmaking club my senior year in high school here in Redlands, California, and the head of the club at the time was a guy named Keith Shardle, and you'll like this, he's got a connection to UFO history here. And Keith was friends with some guys in college that went on to establish their own special effects house, as it's called, and their first gig in the industry was in 76 working on Close Encounters, and they worked for Douglas Trumbull and on and so forth. Anyway, through Keith, I learned that story about U.S. government money going into the production of Close Encounters. And then, you know, after that, I learned that indeed the government had put $20 million into something about UFOs and public relations or something related to UFOs. Apparently that's documented. And it just so happens that the budget for Close Encounters was $20 million. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but now here's the interesting thing I told you about Keith. His father was Paul Shardle, and Paul Shardle was the civilian head of the audiovisual department that was here at Norton Air Force Base. It was called AVIS back then, the Audiovisual Command. Paul Shardle was one of the two people involved with contacting Jacques Vallée and I believe Linda Moulton Howe about showing them UFO films, I think in her case specifically the Holloman film. But that was Keith's father. And he's, you look him up, Paul Shardle, he's very much involved in all the, you know, it looks like the government wants to share UFO truth with people. And Vallée talks about that in one or two of his books. And I didn't know that was Keith's, I didn't know anything about Keith's dad when I met him. I learned that later. And so I'll tell you, I'm very intrigued. I think it's very, very, I mean, it's obviously possible, and it would be so easy for that to be done. I don't believe it in every case. Every time an alien or UFO movie comes out, I don't think it's the government sharing something with us.
Right.
But has it happened? Could it happen? I think it has, and I think it, you know, definitely could.
And it's interesting because, you know, everybody talks about the Brookings report as basically being a report that said, hey, the population is not ready to hear about these things.
Right.
But, you know, I'm in leadership positions, and every time I tell my manager, well, we can't do this, the response is always, well, when can we do it? And so I'm sure that the report that came out was like, well, you shouldn't do this now, but here's a plan that you could put in place that would allow you to do it in the future.
Right.
And so, you know, as a part of that plan, using means that are somewhat innocuous to the public to disseminate information would be key, in my opinion. So,
yeah, it makes sense as a plan. I mean, people watch TV, they watch movies. The whole world we're media focused. And so, you know, yeah, that so much so that seems like a no-brainer. I mean, I'm sure you guys have Hollywood versus the Aliens by Bruce Rux. I mean, what is that, a 2.5-inch thick book that he talks, you know, there you go. It's kind of fun to, when you watch these films and TV shows, to try to figure out which ones have the real info, right?
Yeah, and I was just reading or watching something on Close Encounters because I just got re-interested again. I was like, man, it's been a few years. I want to rewatch it. Uh-huh. And things like that. Well, I was like, I ended up watching, oh, it was on YouTube. I was watching a documentary on it. And because I love that movie so much. And they were talking about, just like what you were talking about, there was government money supposedly in this movie. And when they had finished the movie, it was a much longer movie. And they said that someone came in and was like, so this needs to be taken out. This needs to be taken out. And this needs to be taken out. We like this. We like this. And we like this. And it made for a much shorter movie. And there's a reason why there have been people calling for this legit director's cut for a long time, but they keep getting told it'll never happen.
Yeah.
So yeah, they talked about that in this doc that I watched, that there's a much, much longer movie. And even the director's cut that came out still is missing a lot of stuff that they had originally put in there that this agent said was just a little too close to home.
Y'all are putting too much into it. They put $20 million into it because they wanted people to go to the parks. That's all it was.
You're right. Go to the national park. Same thing with Starman. They wanted people to go to the meteor crater.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, that's good. Well, you know, I forgot to mention, too, back then when Keith told me this, me and a couple of other friends, we were on our way to see a movie, as a matter of fact. We were all going to see a film. And he said at the time his source was someone who worked on the accounting on the film Close Encounters. It wasn't something he had read. It was, you know, and remember, he was friends with guys who worked on the film. So you got to wonder. You just, and then when you go back and watch that one, and, you know, you see the things in it, you know, the idea that, you know, the Devil's Tower, the, you know, the whole national parks thing. But you mentioned the national parks thing. It's like, yeah, it's a big advertisement for going to the national parks. And funny, ever since then, we've emerged with the work of David Pilates, where, golly, now we find out there's a bunch of people missing from
Yeah, really.
Right. Oh.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah.
All part of the plan.
Yeah, it was just, you know, drive them here for the alien buffet. So but well, to take one more thing and tie it to Close Encounters, Stefan and I recently had a chance to get together. So I live in Kentucky right now. Stefan lives in Arizona. But I was out there a few weeks ago, and we went out into this little barren spot, you know, kind of north of Phoenix. And we did a CE5 event, just the two of us, didn't see anything of note. But I had a little EMF detector that I was, you know, had sitting on the ground. And crazy enough, whenever Stefan would play the tones from Close Encounters,
yes,
the EMF detector would light up.
because we had said nothing was happening. I mean, and every time we've gotten together, we've seen something. And here we are in the open desert, in this deserty nook,
right,
like where we should be seeing all kinds of stuff. And it's like the driest night we've ever seen. And I meant that as a pun. But like, we were like, well, maybe we should just keep playing music the whole time, because CE5 is about kind of, you know, staying meditative and things like that. Sure. Yeah. And I couldn't find it, like the music that I liked, until I was like, you know what? Hold on. And I popped on the music for Close Encounters, the tones. And yeah, every time we played that detector went off.
Two things come to mind on that. Number one, the guys at the place where they make the EMF thing, they for some reason they said, hey, just as a goof, let's make this react to the Close Encounters music. Number one. Number two is more serious. That. You have to wonder why those five notes,
right?
Actually, you know, maybe those five notes, you know, this, I'm glad you mentioned that. I've never heard anybody experiment with those five notes or look into those five notes. That's,
well, we've and that's kind of what we've been trying and playing a little bit more with, because we have really been digging into frequencies and things like that, you know, especially, you know, cause, you know, we explore so much stuff on the show and talk to people. So we get into portals and dimensions and just all these other things. And the thing that keeps coming up more than anything is frequencies, especially sound frequencies. They come across almost all the people we talk to about weird events and things like that.
Makes
sense. So who knows?
So, yeah, you know, it's like, you know, if maybe the CE5 tone should actually be just playing the five tones from Close Encounters over and over again. So
yeah, I that'd be worth trying, you know. Yeah. But it also brings up, when you talk about going out to a place like that to do a CE5 kind of thing, you know, you're thinking, okay, you know, it's very natural, people go, okay, let's see if we can detect or contact extraterrestrials. But then there's those other guys out there.
Yeah.
You go out to a place and there's those other guys that mm-hmm. like to fool with human beings and, you know, hey, look, here's some people out here looking for space aliens. Well, let's give them what they think they want. And then you're exposing yourself to any manner of very, very strange things, potentially. Yeah.
I mean, we've always said all the high strangeness out there, it's all just one big term for all the stuff. Every time, yeah, if we're going UFO hunting, all of a sudden we see some eyes in the woods behind us. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's all absolutely connected.
Just, you know, hairy hominids, that's all it is. So.
Hairy hominids.
There you go.
That also sounds, excuse me, but this sounds like a foreign name too.
Jeez. Well, that's, you know, they've just got their cloaking suits on when they're walking around and moving mm-hmm. your stuff around in your house.
So. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I always loved that. Josh, when Josh first came on the show, that was one of his first theories when I first brought him on. And he was just like, what if poltergeists and ghosts were actually ETs or people from another dimension, just in like a cloaked invisibility suit, and they're just moving your stuff around, or they're right. getting scared because you walked too close to them and they bumped into the counter.
I mean, it reminds me of Star Trek Insurrection, you know, where they're all like, you know, monitoring the village, you know, in basically, you know, cloaked suits. And so that's what it kind of, you know, made me think, you know, what if we're being monitored? And they're doing it in a very, what they perceive as, you know, non-interactive way. But then, you know, they're looking in your cabinets to see what kind of specimen, you know, you are, that you keep stuff in your cabinets, and you get up to go to the bathroom and they got to stop what they're doing, you know, and all your cabinet doors are open.
So. Yeah, but they're like, oh!
Everybody freeze.
So it's like when you think you're in an abandoned house kind of ghost hunting or whatever, and somebody comes home and you're like, oh, wait. This is somebody actually here. Oh,
yeah.
My, you know, I freeze too.
Well, especially when you went in through the window, right, Stefan? No, I'm not encouraging that.
So. You know, sometimes I wonder though if it is going to turn out to be, you know, because my dad passed away in 08. My uncle, who I was really close to, passed away in 2016, and I've had another in-law, one of the male in-laws. We got along real well. You know, I still can't help but wonder if it's just all of them messing with me, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, let's make him think it's an alien. Hey, let's make him think it's a monster.
Well, I mean, I'd do it.
I would too.
You know?
Oh, totally. I'm going to mess with my son and everybody if I can.
Well, and it makes you think about, to take it back a little bit to the Shaver mystery, they talked about, you know, in that story, the Darrow have the rays, right, that they point at the unsuspecting humans of the world and make them think that things are going on, as they see things in the sky or whatever. So, yeah.
Hey, I'm glad you brought that up. You guys definitely have the DVD Beyond Lemuria, don't you?
Oh, of course.
Oh, yes. That's a must-have, isn't it? That just, no collection is complete. That's just a delight, that movie.
What was the other thing that, Stefan, we were recently turned on to?
Empire.
It's got Roy Rogers in it.
Gene Autry. It's
Gene Autry. Yeah,
I've got it. In fact, hold on, I've got it right over here across the room.
Yeah, I was like, I have it too, saved on YouTube over here somewhere.
But it's like, there's a, you know, an opening in the hills that takes them into an underground city, and it's about the name of the city is even close to like a Lumeria type city name, and the people that live down there don't want to be discovered, so they send people up to the surface to, you know, stop there from being any interference. It's also very interesting that, you know, some writer somewhere would come up with that story without being influenced somehow, way, shape, or form. So
There are actually three very similar ones. that are old serials. Gene Autry is in the one that's the Phantom Empire.
Phantom Empire. I knew Empire was in there. Couldn't remember what it was.
There's also The Lost City with William Boyd, who, if you recall, I believe was Hopalong Cassidy.
Right.
And then Crash Corrigan was in Undersea Kingdom. And so, but they're similar. They're serials about, you know, the underground, or in this case, the undersea.
Yeah,
with robots and the technology and the evil empire. Very Shaver-esque. And
yeah, we had somebody email us and had said, you guys need to check out Phantom Empire, that it's corny and hokey, but it's based on something real. And then we were like, all right, let's check it out. And we were just blown away.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And when did Shaver first emerge again publicly with his story?
It was like late 40s or late early 40s. I can't remember now.
Because Phantom Empire is 1935. And Lost City is also 1935, and Undersea Kingdom is 36. So what's interesting is, in movies, we had those three out there for 10 years by the time Shaver emerges. But of course, this kind of stuff has been in ancient lore and stuff for
Right. And he says that he started getting the messages in 1932 up until 1934 when he was hospitalized, but he didn't write his letter to Palmer until 1943.
Yeah.
All that stuff. Yeah, that book, Josh, that we read, The Great Smoke God or whatever that was.
Yeah,
The Smoky God. Yeah.
The Smoky God. What an amazing book. God, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's another one. The Hollow Earth and the Piranhas, the Hindu lore.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you familiar with that one?
I've seen it, but it's on my list, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, that's a very interesting book. That's kind of a must have also when you're into this. I'm one of those that last night, it's interesting. Last night, I've been doing this series on my YouTube called Walter Bosley Reads Stuff, and I take a chapter out of either one of my books or anyone else's books off my shelf. I just pull a book off my personal library shelf. And last night I read a chapter from Kenneth Silverman's book on Edgar Allan Poe, a Mournful and Never-Ending Remembrance. And I read the last part of it that involves Poe's death. And I've looked at multiple sources. And in Silverman's book, he presents it as, well, they weren't sure if Poe said Reynolds or Herring. And the Herring thing doesn't fly because other sources, this is on his deathbed. Because other sources pretty much say it was Reynolds and nothing like Herring. And I seem to recall one source saying that his uncle Herring, last name Herring, kind of put it out there that he was saying his name because he wanted the attention, what have you. But I'm one of those that I'm convinced he was saying the name Reynolds, referring to J.N. Reynolds, there's two Reynolds out there. I talk about them in one of my books. But the Reynolds that was involved with John Cleve Sims and the Hollow Earth research, this is the Reynolds who was instrumental with Sims in getting the U.S. Congress to commit money to an expedition to go into the Hollow Earth if they found Sims's theoretical holes and, you know, at the poles.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know that Poe wrote his one novel was the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym. And that's essentially, you know, considered, I think, the first modern Hollow Earth story, because at the end they end up going into the Hollow Earth down in Antarctica. And the whole mystery surrounding Poe's last days, the missing trunk. To this day, they've never found the trunk that he left Richmond with, so nobody knows exactly what was in it. And there he is on his deathbed just muttering Reynolds, Reynolds, Reynolds. Mm-hmm. And we know that he was interested in this Hollow Earth stuff. We know that there was Reynolds involved in that. I'm convinced that he was muttering something about Reynolds, and it makes me wonder just what the heck was that all about? And right. was there anything to do with secrets of the earth or secrets that Poe learned that had anything to do with why he died the way he did? And then I subsequently, when I was doing research on my last book, I learned about the eerily similar fate of Admiral Byrd's son. Are you familiar with that?
Not with his son. I mean, we're familiar with Byrd, obviously.
Admiral Byrd's son was a naval officer, and he was with him on the South American or the Antarctica. Operation High Jump, right? The famous one where they were supposed to go down for 6 months, and 6 weeks later, they're hightailing it away from the South Pole back home. His son was on that expedition with him and yet never talked about it. His son also ends up disappearing. He's gone for several days, I think a few weeks. Just like Poe, he is found in an indigent condition, ratty old clothes that weren't his. When he left home to go to a ceremony celebrating his father in D.C., he was wearing a nice suit. This is a man who had money. He's found in an indigent condition in Baltimore. Poe was in Baltimore in an indigent condition. He had been drinking. There was alcohol involved with Admiral Byrd's son's situation, and he's found dead in this warehouse, this abandoned warehouse in Baltimore, just like essentially Poe, you know, was found in the street in Baltimore.
Wow.
And
yeah,
it's kind of like that Abraham Lincoln JFK weirdness, you know, and synchronicity. Yeah. Hmm. But yet here's the connection. You got these two men who have a personal connection to the whole Hollow Earth mystery. And they and what's going on there? You know, they end up, you know, almost the same exact fate. It's just those are the kinds of things that fascinate me. You know, and what did Poe, what did Admiral Byrd's son know about this stuff that we're not being told?
Well, it makes me wonder if anybody's ever done a, you know, information, freedom of information for anything from that Byrd expedition.
Yeah, you would think with the hundreds of people that were on that expedition, doesn't it seem like that by now, and this you could argue either way, the skeptic would say, or the realist, you know, realistic person would say, look, you would think with the hundreds of people or whatever that were on that expedition, and there were, you would have thought by now someone else would have talked, there would have been something else, you know, to corroborate these wild stories. Now, let's say that again from a different perspective. Gee, you would have thought by now we would have got the details on this expedition and learned more about it, but we don't. It's been how many decades and right. we still aren't told, you know?
Right, right.
So you could look at it both ways. And then when you look at the mysterious death of his son, you know, you wonder if that possibly could have had any bearing, or was he just a poor guy with a you know, a mental health condition? And
right,
you know, it's
I don't know.
What they do is when these things happen, there's just like with Poe, it's just ambiguous enough where it could be plausibly denied, and as we know, that's factored into so much, right? The plausible deniability.
And it doesn't hurt that all this stuff is still so very much taboo in society, right? Because then they can just society, you know, as a whole, will just kind of sweep it under the rug, sure. blame it on a mental illness, you know, bring it on a drinking or a drug habit or whatever the case may be, and let it go.
Oh, he just got drunk and, you know, sold his clothes for some, traded his clothes for some booze, you know, silk tie, a nice suit, you know, or he got mugged.
Right.
But if I'm not mistaken, I think did they, I'd have to look again, but I can't recall if they found his ID on him or not. But it was, I can't help but wonder, to me, there's just enough ambiguity that it justifies wondering if there's something more weird to the whole thing, some secret to the whole thing.
Always. Yep. Always. I mean, just always. I'll just leave it.
Yeah.
There.
So I want to be, you know, we've only got a few minutes left because I want to be mindful of your time, but I want to know. I've read some things. I've watched the episode you're on for Ancient Aliens. I'm curious, and this is probably more of a conversation than we have time to get into. Secret space program.
Oh, well, as you guys know or have heard or probably familiar with, you know, I was invited to be a part of the secret space program, little milieu there that we're doing those conferences from the perspective of, I can think of no other word than legitimate research, mm-hmm. where people, you know, from finance, from aerospace technology, from the historical research perspective, like myself and Joseph Farrell and stuff, right. I was invited to be a part of that milieu about the time of the last of the three conferences they were doing. And for some years, there had been people doing this serious, no pun intended, down-to-earth research on the idea of a secret space program. More accurately, what I've come to call, like, you know, classified space program, right?
Right.
And that got, and you're right, that's a whole other conversation that I'd love to have on a future sit down with you guys.
Yeah,
for sure. But that focus was on the right track. And each one of those conferences, I went to the second one, I spoke at the third one, and from what I learned and what I saw, each conference, the attendees at these conferences were not the, God bless them, the usual folks you see at the UFO conferences with all the new age stuff. No, these were like people that you normally wouldn't see at any other kind of conference like this. And they were seriously interested in this, and they wanted serious speakers, no la-la, no woo stuff. And each conference was drawing a larger crowd, and they and some of the speakers were starting to get more attention in our you know, the media in this community. And about that time when it was really taking off, well, the whole conversation got sidetracked and usurped by all this ridiculous 20 and back time jumping space commando nonsense of, you know, Corey Good and Emery Smith, mm-hmm. and, you know, knuckleheads like that. And it really and of course, unfortunately, God bless them again, the media in our community were all too happy to give those guys all the spotlight.
Oh yeah.
And get the attention off of what we call serious SSP research. So I do think that was kind of done / allowed to happen, a combination of both, to get people off attention from the idea that, yes, I think there has been a classified American space program since the late 1940s. I have put forth my theory, hypothesis, that that's what Roswell actually was our first manned attempt at manned spaceflight. Mm. And it worked up until, you know, they crashed at the end or they learned something. Yeah. And we know that the U.S. Air Force was totally committed to putting people in space. They initiated the Mercury program, which NASA took over in 1958. But the Air Force had been developing that. Well, I'm a great advocate of, this is something that has existed classified. Parallel to what NASA's been doing, but with a military mission. The reason that I kind of, you know, just let go of the, you know, just kind of lost steam on that was, I really think that with the standing up of Space Force, mm-hmm. that anything we were doing classified is just going to be folded into Space Force. In other words, it'll become the classified history of what Space Force is. And I see the emergence of Space Force as kind of proof that this is what we wanted to do all along. And to some extent, we were doing it. So,
yeah.
So when I say SSP, when someone says SSP to me, legitimately, that's what I think of is what we've been doing secretly. Now, I don't think that what we were doing all these years was some hidden secret fleet like Starfleet in the movies. That's utterly ridiculous. I think the technology was virtually parallel with the military secret program a little bit ahead, right? And yeah. inching ahead. And I think that by the late 70s, early 80s is probably when the military took a classified military program that I'm proposing would have taken its first significant leap forward from what we saw NASA doing.
Just Walter, can you hear us?
Men in Black.
Every time.
Maybe, as remember Gary McKinnon talked about, maybe something like the size of a submarine, right? The, you know.
So Walter, I have to tell you that right as you were getting to the crux of your what you were saying,
the internet went out, didn't it?
You cut out, and you're like, it's happened.
It's happened to us every time we've talked about the secret space program.
Yep.
It's cut out on us.
Somebody has either been dropped, they disconnect, randomly lose internet, whatever. It's like, you know, Men in Black. Men in Black is that stuff on here.
Yeah. Well, you know what we'll have to do is I'll have to come back and we'll dedicate a whole hour.
100%. For sure. We're already looking at some amazing stuff. Because, yeah, like we said, how Hollow Earth stuff was this year's obsession. Last year's obsession was Secret Space Program. We discovered the series Deep Space on Gaia, which of course is pretty amazing. And then we met Ken Johnston because my little brother used to be in Civil Air Patrol in Albuquerque, and one of his commanders was Ken Johnston.
Oh, wow.
And I couldn't believe it. My little brother's like, oh yeah, I didn't tell you I know Ken. And I'm like, no, you didn't know Ken. And so yeah, got me connected to Ken, and he said, my brother's got all kinds of stories of things Ken and other guys that were there that they would talk about stuff, you know, pictures they had seen and stuff. And it was just, yeah, that was our obsession for that year.
What is this last year's obsession, this year's obsession? It's every year.
It's every year, but it's one kind of a flashlight gets put on.
No, I get you. Yeah.
We're always researching all the things we love.
Anytime it pops up, man, it's a great discussion. And you know, like I said, because I like to be honest, and let's be honest with ourselves, I think we all know there's a bunch of charlatans and fakers that tend to wander into our community, and they wreak havoc. You know, they lead people astray. And so I have no problem with debunking nonsense. Yeah. But, you know, that can give some people the impression that, oh, this guy doesn't think anything. And I'm like, that couldn't be farther from the truth. I'm a believer with a lot of you folks out there. But I like to, you know, I like to see people focusing on the things that are the real mysteries that rather than the nonsense, because the nonsense, you never know when we're being manipulated by the nonsense to distract us from the real, you know.
Yep.
So we have to police that stuff, you know.
100%.
So time to time, you gotta call them out.
But you know, I'll make this statement, and then we'll let you go. But one of the things that I've been really thinking about lately is all this stuff that's really brought our attention back to the skies.
Yeah.
Is it distracting us from things that are happening in the oceans and underground?
Right. Yeah, I'll say this. You guys, I'm sure, are familiar with Greg Bishop. Yeah. I've known Greg for some years, and he's always said something that I really like. He says, you know what? If I were to see a UFO, my inclination would be to turn around and look behind me to see what it's distracting me from.
Yep.
And I like that. Yeah. And that's exactly what you just said is, hey, everybody, look to the skies. Is that because they don't want us to look under our feet?
Right.
Yep. They're shifting their focus.
Yeah.
Yep.
So. Interesting. Well, Walter, thank you. Yes. Thank you so much. Of course, we want to give you a second. If there's anything you wanted to plug or any places people can find you, we'd love to, you know, you could share that information.
Sure. I've been a publisher, as you guys mentioned earlier. I've been a publisher. I'm going into my 20th year, the 19 years. Ooh. And I publish other authors and stuff. But my stuff is not at Amazon. I want to say this. Amazon is not good for small press publishers. That's why you don't find me there. They take all your royalties. It's not a good deal for the small guy, and I'm a small publishing house. My stuff is printed and distributed through Lulu.com. I'm the publisher. Lulu's just the printer and distributor.
Yeah,
they do
like
print on demand. They do really good quality books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very pleased. I've been with Lulu for 11 years now, and you can find all my books at Lulu.com, Lulu.com. And just put my name in there. and the stuff that I've written and the stuff by other authors that I've published, that will all pop up. And also I have my YouTube, the Walter Bosley channel. And that's where I let my hair down a little bit on live stream Sunday afternoons, but I also do other content, pre-recorded content. And, you know, I think you'll find something to interest you there. So I appreciate being on, guys. I really enjoyed this.
We absolutely, this man. And we are definitely directing our folks there. We've ordered a number of books from Lulu. So I definitely agree with the quality there. And we'll be following you. And absolutely, we will be in touch, because I would love to spend as much time as we talked about Hollow Earth on Secret Space Program. So let's plan to do that for sure. So.
And I'll just say to folks, if you check out my live stream, don't be scared away by my level of enthusiasm. I get riled up, but it's all in good. I keep humor about it and stuff. So, but you, I think you'll enjoy it. A lot of people do.
If they're listening to us, they'll dig that.
Yeah.
Because we get riled up too.
Yeah.
So thanks again, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Anytime.
All righty.
And thank you, thank you, thank you, Walter Bosley. Good Lord, people. I did not want to stop. I could have kept talking all night. You listeners, you guys know how much we love Hollow Earth and Secret Space Program.
I feel like we
didn't even get into ancient civilizations, which I know we could have got into.
No, I mean, we like barely touched the surface of all the stuff that we could have talked about. So we'll definitely have Walter back on for sure.
Oh, 100%. And definitely, I'm already there on his YouTube page. You can search the Walter Bosley channel. That's Bosley. All of his great stuff is there. And of course, go to lulu.com. Same thing. So much great content, so much fun. I am gonna be I have a busy next couple of days, because I'm gonna be watching all of these, because man, I told you I love Pulp Fiction and stuff like that. I love those old pulp magazines and stuff, so it's gonna be a lot of fun. But anyways, we gotta get out of here, Josh. I hate to go, because I know that it's gonna be a couple weeks for a solid get them and grip them episode.
I grip them real good if they sprinkle grippos all over themselves.
Why do they gotta put? I'm not even gonna bother.
No, just let it go.
Merry Chris McConaughey.
He's still on it about us covering a tree.
Yeah, he's still mad. Anyways, what a great episode. Just again, reminder, go to fearscapepodcast.com/support if you want to help support us, especially next year. We're ramping up now to book guests, and because of the I don't want to say success, that's not the right word, that makes me sound egotistical, but because of the success we've had with the people we've had this year, we're able to meet and talk to some managers and publicists and agents and stuff that are out there, folks that are interested in being on our show, but they have a very busy schedule, so they're not free to get. And we very much would like to speak to some of these people and things like that. So your donations will help us get to speak to some of these people, as well as go on tour, do all the things that we do, and just, help push this this empire of Fearscape as far as possible between the media network and everything we do here on Astral Stew, our YouTube channel. We've got some stuff coming out in 2022 with the YouTube channel, some cool stuff that's going to be happening, and just a lot of really great stuff. I'm really excited for everyone to see what we have in store for next year. It's going to be a fantastic year, and we couldn't have done that without the support we've already received from Patreon and Buy Me a Coffee, and just the other types of support that we've been given.
So. People buying t-shirts and hoodies
and
clocks and all kinds of stuff.
I mean, we put that stuff on there just to see what happens, and you would be surprised the stuff people buy, man.
A
Jersey Devil clock is out there, man.
Well, and I didn't know until I saw it that I really didn't think anybody would ever buy a Jersey Devil bath mat. But somebody wanted it.
People love the Jersey Devil.
I know, people love me. Hey, you gotta love me. I'm like baby dinosaur on the dinosaur show.
You're just not as cute.
Yeah.
You're not as cute. But anyways, yeah, you can get all your Jersey Devil merchandise and all that stuff. But, you know, all that stuff. But yeah, Christmas is coming up, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, you know, all that stuff. So there's some great gifts on there for your even if folks aren't Fearscape lovers. Like we said, there's lots of other stuff that's there. You know, with me being pagan, there's some cool witchy stuff. I think we just put a Bruja shirt up there, too, as well. So I'm totally digging that. I love that we have a Bruja shirt. So but anyways, we're going to get out. But we're going to get out of here. I just don't want to go, Josh.
Well, yeah, it's just, you know, thanks everybody again for sticking around. It's been a fantastic year. We're going to do the listener story, and then, you know, you'll have to catch the kind of little things are going to drop in December, but we're coming back strong in January. So you're not going to want to miss.
Yeah, don't forget
the
opening
episode
with that Rendlesham Forest incident, man.
Yep.
Some hot diggity goodness right there. I'm hoping we can come back before then as well. Maybe do a retrospective of the year. That could be fun.
Yep.
You know, keep your eyes on YouTube and Facebook Live. Thank you to everybody that showed up on Facebook Live last week. That was an absolute pleasure. We loved getting to talk to you guys. So, but anyways, let's go ahead and get to our final segment of the year. Encounters from the Fearscape. Josh, I'm really excited about this story because we were emailed this one. You know, whenever these pop up, we're like, oh, cool. Because, you know, a lot of times they come through social media or through the submit a sighting. We get a lot right. through the submit a sighting. So I got this one in an email, and it, the name of the email said my crazy so-called abduction, which I already liked because, you know, we grew up in the age of my so-called life with Claire Danes, who I still love. So I loved that. But this comes from a listener named Jenna. No last name. We're not going to do a last name here. But Jenna sent us this amazing story, and I don't even know what else to say. So I'm just going to leave it at that. So let's go from here. Here is Jenna's encounter from the Fearscape. Let me tell you my personal abduction story. It happened a few years ago, and I'm just now putting all the pieces together and understanding what really happened. So let me start from the beginning. It was a dark night, one with no moon, and it was completely still and quiet. I was staying at my home in Texas, just south of the Oklahoma line, out in the middle of nowhere, so there weren't many people around. There was an old family home that was my grandparents' home, and it was left to me when they died. That night, I was washing dishes after dinner, and I remember seeing a strange pulsating and very bright purple light out of the window. But the next thing I remember is waking up in the morning with a terrible headache, not knowing how I got in my bed. I sat up in the bed dazed and confused, and then I remembered I had my iPhone, and I was trying to take a video of the light before I blacked out. So I quickly scrambled to my phone and found that the battery was completely dead. So I went ahead and had breakfast while the phone was on the charger. After eating, I returned to my phone and I watched what was probably the most disturbing thing I have ever seen in my life. The video showed a bright flashing purple light in the yard, but other than that, no detail. I'm on the video saying things like, oh, how strange, and where is it coming from, and you know, the standard ordeal. I squeal suddenly, and then I turn around, and the camera only catches a quick glimpse of someone or thing, white-skinned and short, with large eyes and long arms and fingers. I paused it, and I looked at this blurred image so long and so many times. I then, in the video, scream and scream over and over while the phone drops to the floor.
And the camera's face down, so the only thing I can see is blackness, but I can hear my own muffled screams grow fainter and fainter and further away until finally just nothing for an hour, and then it stops. And that's all for the video. After watching the video, I immediately called my dad, and he tells me he is coming over immediately. It is in this time that he is driving to me that I started having memories of what happened. I remember very scattered details of being strapped to a table of some sort and testing being done on me. Then I remember being cleaned up in some sort of strange shower-like place and then returned to my home. I remember seeing large and small white beings, with one being in charge that had a larger white stick that he carried. It's all like a dream to me still. But the strangest thing is this. I feel like something is in one of my legs, to the point that it makes it seem like it's much heavier than the other. Has anyone else ever felt like something was placed in their leg? Am I alone in this? Well, as for the video, my dad got there, watched it, and immediately, without asking, erased it. He began yelling at me and telling me to forget about it and not to worry because this will never happen again. And I sat there, I was just crying. I was so confused. This was not like my father. My dad went outside and he's just chanting something that I had never heard before while scattering something around my home that looked some sort of like a white dust or talcum powder or something. When I walked out to the porch and asked him what he was doing, he looked at me and said,
"I'll tell you one day, Jenna, when you are ready. But right now, I need a glass of water."
And so I went inside to get him a glass of water, and when I came back out, he was gone. He was just gone. Even his truck was gone. Now the doors and windows were open. He has an old 1980s F-150. It's loud. I never heard it. I never heard it start. I never heard it leave. I never heard a door slam. A few minutes later, as I sat there dumbfounded drinking the glass of water my dad asked for, I heard the sound of his truck's engine as he pulls onto my property. He flies up my property and slams on the brakes and runs out of the car to me asking if I was okay and that he got there as fast as he could. And I told him he was crazy because he was already here and then somehow quietly left. And he assured me he had not. And he showed me on his phone how he had been talking to my mother the entire drive over here. I checked the call log. I sat there more scared than I was minutes earlier because the time signature matched when he was here. To this day, I don't know who or what pretended to be my dad, or if I was simply hallucinating it all, or wondering to myself how it all tied together with the video. How does it all tie with the memories that I had of my, I guess, abduction? So later that night, I walked around my house near my garden, and I saw the white dust my so-called dad was sprinkling around while chanting in a strange language. Of course, later it rained, and it just washed all of that dust away. But after that night, after the dust had been put around my house, I surprisingly slept more soundly than I had ever slept in my entire life, especially besides the night before. I have never had another abduction experience, nor have I ever had another run-in with the man or thing that pretended to be my father, at least that I'm aware of. But I can't help but wonder, to this day what the hell it really was. And I still feel like there's something inside my leg, but I'm just too afraid to get an x-ray and find out. You know, maybe the truth is not something I would find comforting. So since Fake Dad deleted my video, I don't have any evidence of what happened, and that pisses me off. And also, I have to admit, I look out the window scared every night before I go to bed to this day. Well, thanks for listening, guys. I really love your show.
That strikes a chord with me, Josh. Yeah. So, you know, some of you guys know that when we were in Somerset, I did a past life regression with Santosh and Josh. And it's a little private, so I'm not sure whether or not I'll share it or not one day or anything like that. But I definitely had some memories or some make-em-ups. I don't know. But some of what happened in that, there were some similarities to her memories there. Especially the, you know, the table and the short and tall versions.
Yeah.
And things like that. So, yeah, it's frightening. And Jenna, if you're listening, let us know if anything does ever happen. And if you, you know, are struggling with any of this, you know, let us know. We can help you find a support group. We can help you find anything like that. Or if you were just wanting to share the story because it was cool, that's cool too. Yep. We love these stories and we thank you for that. And as always, you can email us at fearscapepodcast@gmail.com or submit a sighting, fearscapepodcast.com. There's a submit a sighting tab there, or just hit us up on our social medias and DM us all of that. But yeah, I'm a little shaken by that story. It's a good one, Josh. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a yes. I mean, it of course it meets all the boxes of a typical what we hear is typical, you know, kind of abduction case.
And Men in Black. Sure. I mean, you know, Black, the guy wanting a glass of water. You know, and I'm wondering if her real dad hadn't showed up, you know, would Fake Dad have disappeared, or would he have taken his pill that you always hear about them taking with the glass of water? I don't know, man. I don't know. But yeah, fantastic. Again, thank you, Jenna. But Josh, I don't know about you, but let's go ahead and get out of here. You know, twas the month before Christmas and all through the house.
Yep.
Not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. But yeah, I want to get snug in my bed. I hope you guys get snug in yours and you pull those blankets up tight.
Yep. So again, thank you very much for your continued listening. It's been a fantastic year and looking forward to 2022.
As am I. So Josh, I love you, brother. But thank you everyone for listening to Fearscape Paranormal Podcast here on the Fearscape Media Network. I have been Stefan, and just a reminder to keep your eyes on the skies.
And this has been Josh. The truth is now.
And remember, folks, hold those blankets extra tight because things tend to get spooky when you're listening to Fearscape. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
We hope you have enjoyed this guidepost on the road of high strangeness with us. And we thank you, as always, for listening and joining our caravan to the weird and unknown. Please consider supporting us as we continue our journey to find the answers we all seek. FearscapePodcast.com/support.